This is Audible.
Dreamscape presents Fluent Forever, How to Learn Any Language Fast and Never Forget It by Gabriel Weiner. Narrated by the author. This is an audiobook adaptation of Fluent Forever. The audio format gives us a lot of things. You can hear the intonation and inflection of my voice, and I can actually give you real pronunciation examples. That said, the audio format also takes some things away. It's harder to keep track of web links to online tools, and you can't see any of the illustrations and diagrams in my book. Illustrations that can be particularly useful when we talk about flashcard designs in the section of the book entitled The Gallery. To help you out with that, I've created a page on my website that will show you what you're missing. To access it, go to fluent-forever.com/audiobook. Chapter 1. Introduction. Stab, stab, stab. If you talk to a man in a language he understands, that goes to his head. If you talk to him in his language, that goes to his heart. Nelson Mandela. Americans who travel abroad for the first time are often shocked to discover that, despite all the progress that has been made in the last 30 years, many foreign people still speak in foreign languages. Dave Barry. Language learning is a sport. I say this as someone who is in no way qualified to speak about sports. I joined the fencing team in high school in order to get out of gym class. Still, stabbing friends with pointy metal objects resembles language learning more than you might think. Your goal in fencing is to stab people automatically. You spend time learning the names of the weapons and the rules of the game, and you drill the proper posture, every parry, riposte, and lunge. And finally, you play the game, hoping to reach that magical moment when you forget about the rules. Your arm moves of its own accord. You deftly parry your friend's sword, and you stab him squarely in the chest. Point. We want to walk up to someone, open our mouths, forget the rules, and speak automatically. This goal can seem out of reach because languages seem hard, but they're not. There's no such thing as a hard language. Any idiot can speak whatever language his parents spoke when he was a child. The real challenge lies in finding a path that conforms to the demands of a busy life. In the midst of my own busy life as an opera singer, I needed to learn German, French, Italian, and Russian. Out of those experiences, I found the underpinnings for this book. My methods are the result of an obsessive need to tinker, research, and then tinker again. My language learning toolbox has, over time, turned into a well-oiled machine that transforms fixed amounts of daily time into noticeable, continuous improvement in my languages, and in the languages of every person I've taught. In sharing it, I hope to enable you to visit the peculiar world of language learning. In the process, you'll better understand the inner workings of your mind and the minds of others. And you'll learn to speak a new language, too. Beginnings. So far, my favorite moment of this crazy language learning adventure took place in a Viennese subway station in 2012. I was returning home from a show when I saw a Russian colleague coming toward me. Our common language had always been German, and so in that language we greeted and caught up on the events of the past year. And then I dropped the bomb. "You know, I speak Russian now," I told her in Russian. The expression on her face was priceless. Her jaw actually dropped, like in the cartoons. She stammered, "What? When? How?" as we launched into a long conversation in Russian about language learning, life, and the intersection between the two. My first attempts to learn languages were significantly less jaw-dropping. I went to Hebrew school for 7 years. We sang songs, we learned the alphabet, lit lots of candles, drank lots of grape juice, and didn't learn much of anything. Well, except the alphabet. I had that alphabet nailed. In high school, I fell in love with my Russian teacher, Mrs. Nowakowski. She was smart and pretty, she had a wacky Russian last name, and I did whatever she asked whenever she asked. 5 years later, I had learned a few phrases, memorized a few poems, learned that alphabet quite well, thank you very much, and by the end of it, I got the impression that something was seriously wrong. Why can I only remember alphabets? Why was everything else so hard? Now fast forward to June of 2004, at the start of a German immersion program for opera singers in Vermont. At the time, I was an engineer with an oversized singing habit. This habit demanded that I learn basic German, French, and Italian, and I decided that jumping into the pool was the only way I'd ever succeed. Upon my arrival, I was to sign a paper pledging to use German as my only form of communication for 7 weeks, under threat of expulsion without refund. At the time, this seemed unwise, as I didn't speak a word of German. I signed it anyway. Afterward, some advanced students approached me, smiled, and said, "Hallo." I stared at them blankly for a moment and replied, hallo? We shook hands. 5 insane weeks later, I sang my heart out in a German acting class, found a remote location on campus, and stealthily called my girlfriend. I think I'm going to be an opera singer, I told her in whispered English. On that day, I decided to become fluent in the languages demanded by my new profession. I went back to Middlebury College in Vermont and took German again. This time, I reached fluency. I moved to Austria for my master's studies. While living in Europe in 2008, I went to Perugia, Italy, to learn Italian. 2 years later, I became a cheater. Cheaters occasionally prosper. The 3 keys to language learning. This book would not exist if I had not cheated on a French test. I'm not proud of it, but there it is. First, some background. The Middlebury language schools offer 5 levels of classes. Absolute beginner, false beginner, these are people who have forgotten what they've learned, intermediate, advanced, and near fluent. At the time of the test, I was an absolute beginner in French, but I had already learned a Romance language and I wanted to be with the false beginners. So for my 3rd stint at Middlebury, I cheated on the online placement test, using Google Translate and some grammar websites. Don't tell Middlebury. A month later, I received my regrettable results. Welcome and congratulations, it began. You've been placed in the intermediate level. Shit. I had 3 months to learn a year's worth of French or look like an idiot at the entrance interview. These interviews are serious business. You sit in a room with a real, live French person. You chat for 15 minutes about life, and then you leave with a final class placement. You can't cheat. You can either speak French or make sad faces and wave your hands around like a second-rate Parisian mime. As I was in the middle of completing master's degrees in opera and art song, the only free time I had was an hour on the subway every day and all day on Sundays. I frantically turned to the internet to figure out how to learn a language faster. And what I found was surprising. There are a number of incredibly powerful language learning tools out there, but no single program put all of the new methods together. I encountered 3 basic keys to language learning. 1, learn pronunciation first. 2, don't translate. And 3, use spaced repetition systems. The first key, learn pronunciation first, came out of my music conservatory training and is widely used by the military and missionaries of the Mormon Church. Singers learn the pronunciation of languages first because we need to sing in these languages long before we have the time to learn them. In the course of mastering the sounds of a language, our ears become attuned to those sounds, making vocabulary acquisition, listening comprehension, and speaking come much more quickly. And while we're at it, we pick up a snazzy, accurate accent. Now the second key, don't translate, was hidden within my experiences at the Middlebury language schools in Vermont. Not only can a beginning student skip translating, but it was an essential step in learning how to think in a foreign language. It made language learning possible. This was the fatal flaw in my earlier attempts to learn Hebrew and Russian. I was practicing translation instead of speaking. By throwing away English, I could spend my time building fluency instead of decoding sentences word by word. The third key, use spaced repetition systems, or SRSs, came from language blogs and software developers. SRSs are flashcards on steroids. Based upon your input, they create a custom study plan that drives information deep into your long-term memory. They supercharge memorization, and they have yet to reach mainstream use. A growing number of language learners on the internet were taking advantage of SRSs, but they were using them to memorize translations. Conversely, no translation proponents like Middlebury and Berlitz were using comparatively antiquated study methods, failing to take advantage of the new computerized learning tools. And meanwhile, no one but the classical singers and the Mormons seemed to care much about pronunciation. I decided to use all of these methods at once. I used memorization software on my smartphone to get the French into my head, and I made sure that none of my flashcards had a word of English on them. I began making flashcards for the pronunciation rules, added a bunch of pictures for the nouns and some verbs, learned the verb conjugations, and then built up to some simple French definitions of more abstract concepts. By June, in my hour a day on the subway, I had learned 3,000 words and grammar concepts. When I arrived at Middlebury, I waited in a room for my entrance interview in French. This interview was meant to ensure I hadn't done anything stupid, like cheat on my online placement test. It was the first time I had ever spoken French in my life. The teacher sat down and said, "Bonjour," and I responded right back with the very first word that came into my brain, "Bonjour." So far, so good. As our conversation evolved, I was amazed to find that I knew all the words she was saying, and I knew all the words I needed to respond. I could think in French. It was halting, but it was French. I was stunned. Middlebury bumped me up into the advanced class. In those 7 weeks, I read 10 books, wrote 70 pages worth of essays, and my vocabulary grew to 4,500 words. By the beginning of August, I was fluent in French. The game plan. What is fluency? Each of us will find a different answer to this question. The term is imprecise, and it means a little less every time someone writes another book, article, or spam email with a title like, "You be fluent in 7 days!" exclamation. Still, we maintain an image of fluency in our minds. It's a summer afternoon in a Parisian cafe, casually chatting up the waitress without needing to worry about verb conjugations or missing words in our vocabularies. Beyond that cafe, we must decide individually how far we wish to go. I would confidently describe myself as fluent in German. I've lived in Austria for 6 years and will happily discuss anything with anyone, but I certainly needed to dance around a few missing words to get out of a 200-euro fine for my rental car's broken gas cap. Apparently, the word for gas cap is Tankdeckel, and the words for "I don't give a damn if I'm the first person to drive this car, the spring holding the gas cap closed was defective" start with "Das ist mir völlig wurscht," and go on from there. You'll have to determine for yourself whether your image of fluency includes political discussions with friends, attending poetry readings, working as a secret agent, or lecturing on quantum physics at the Sorbonne. We struggle to reach any degree of fluency because there is so much to remember. The rulebook of the language game is too long. We go to classes that discuss the rulebook, we run drills about one rule or another, but we never get to actually play the game. On the off chance that we ever reach the end of a rulebook, we've forgotten most of the beginning already. Moreover, we've ignored the other book, that vocabulary book, full of thousands upon thousands of words that are just as hard to remember as the rules. Forgetting is our greatest foe, and we need a plan to defeat it. What's the classic language learning success story? A guy moves to Spain, falls in love with a Spanish girl, and spends every waking hour practicing the language until he is fluent within the year. This is the immersion experience, and it defeats forgetting with brute force. In large part, our proud Spanish-speaking hero is successful because he never had any time to forget. Every day, he swims in an ocean of Spanish. How could he forget what he had learned? I learned German in this way. Given an opportunity to leave my job, move to Vermont, and cut off all ties to the English-speaking world for 2 full summers. Immersion is a wonderful experience, but if you have steady work, a dog, family, or a bank account in need of refilling, you can't readily drop everything and devote that much of your life to learning a language. We need a more practical way to get the right information into our heads and prevent it from leaking out of our ears. I'm going to show you how to stop forgetting so you can get to the actual game. And I'm going to show you what to remember so that once you start playing the game, you're good at it. Along the way, we'll rewire your ears to hear new sounds and rewire your tongue to master a new accent. We'll investigate the makeup of words, how grammar assembles those words into thoughts, and how to make those thoughts come out of your mouth without needing to waste time translating. We'll make the most of your limited time investigating which words to learn first, how to use mnemonics to memorize abstract concepts faster, and how to improve your reading, writing, listening, and speaking skills as quickly and effectively as possible. I want you to understand how to use the tools I found along the way, but I also want you to understand why they work. Language learning is one of the most intensely personal journeys you can undertake. You're going into your own mind and altering the way you think. If you're going to spend months or years working at that goal, you need to believe in these methods and make them your own. If you know how to approach the language game, you can beat it. I hope to show you the shortest path to that goal, so you can forget the rules and start playing already. After I learned German, I thought, ah, if I could just go back in time and tell myself a few things, I would have had a much easier time with this language. I had precisely the same thought after Italian, French, Russian, which I finally learned in 2012, and Hungarian, 2013's project. This book is my time machine. If I squint my eyes just right, then you are monolingual me from 9 years ago, and I'm creating a time paradox by helping you avoid all the pitfalls and potholes that led me to make my time machine in the first place. You know how it is. How long does fluency take? To estimate the time you'll need, we'll need to consider your fluency goals, the language or languages you already know, the language you're learning, and your daily time constraints. As I said earlier, there is no such thing as a hard language, but there are, however, languages that will be harder for you to learn, because they aren't in the same family as the language or languages you already know. Japanese is difficult for English speakers to learn, for the same reason that English is difficult for Japanese speakers. There are precious few words and grammatical concepts that overlap in both languages, not to mention the entirely different alphabets involved. In contrast, an English speaker learning French has much less work to do. English vocabulary is 28% French and 28% Latin. As soon as an English speaker learns proper French pronunciation, he already knows thousands of words. The U.S. Foreign Service Institute ranks languages by their approximate difficulty for native English speakers. We talk about that at the end in Appendix 2. In my experience, their estimates are spot on. As they predicted, Russian, a level 2 language, took me nearly twice as much time as French, a level 1 language. And I suspect that Japanese, which is a level 3 language, that'll take me twice as much time as Russian. I reached a comfortable intermediate, I can think in French and use a monolingual dictionary level, in 3 months, working for an hour a day plus weekend binges. And I reached a similar level in Russian in 6 months, at 30 to 45 minutes a day plus weekend binges. I then used 7 to 8 weeks of intensive immersion to bring both of those languages to advanced, comfortable in a cafe, comfortable chatting about whatever, somewhat uncomfortable describing car problems levels. I've seen similar results with my students. Without an immersion program, I suspect advanced French would take 5 to 8 months, working for 30 to 45 minutes per day on your own. Level 2 languages like Russian and Hebrew should be twice that. And level 3 languages like Chinese, Arabic, Japanese, and Korean should take 4 times as long as French. These harder languages do take time, but there's no reason you can't learn them. You've already met the only prerequisite. You're interested. Think about exercise for a moment. To succeed at an exercise routine, we need to enjoy it or we'll drop it. Most of us don't have six-pack abs or fit into a size 2 dress. I've certainly tried for the abs. I gave up on that size 2 dress long ago, but I never succeeded because I rarely enjoy exercise. Those of us who do succeed. Successful gym rats learn to find the joy and the endorphins in grueling daily workouts. The rest of us can push ourselves into the gym with willpower, but if we don't find it enjoyable, we're unlikely to continue for the 6 to 24 months we need to see results. Fitness plans keep shrinking in time. 30-minute fitness, the 10-minute solution, ultimate physical fitness in 5 minutes, the 3-minute workout, in an attempt to make something that's difficult seem more palatable. But no matter what, we're still going to be a sweaty, achy mess at the end of it, and getting ourselves fired up to do it every day is hard in the short term and harder in the long term. As long as language learning is hard, we'll run into the same problems. Who enjoys drilling grammar and memorizing word lists? Even if I promise you fluency in 30 seconds a day, you're going to have a hard time sticking to it if it's unpleasant. So we're going to drop the boring stuff and find something more exciting. The tools I've assembled here are effective, but much more important, they're fun to use. We enjoy learning. It's what addicts us to reading newspapers, books, and magazines, and browsing websites like Lifehacker, Facebook, Reddit, and The Huffington Post. Every time we see a new factoid, e.g., in AD 536, a dust cloud blotted out the sun over Europe and Asia for an entire year, causing famines that wiped out populations from Scandinavia to China, and no one knows what caused it. The pleasure centers of our brains burst into activity, and we click on the next link. In this book, we're going to addict ourselves to language learning. The discovery process for new words and grammar will be our new Facebook. The assembly process for new flashcards will be a series of quick arts and crafts projects, and the memorization process will be a fast-paced video game that's just challenging enough to keep us interested. There's no coincidence here. We learn better when we're having fun. And in looking for the fastest ways to learn, I naturally ended up with the most enjoyable methods. My favorite thing about language learning is this. I can basically play video games as much as I like without suffering deep existential regret afterward. E.g., I can't believe I just wasted 6 hours of my life playing stupid games on Facebook. I spend 30 to 60 minutes a day playing on my smartphone or watching TV. The TV series Lost, incidentally, is awesome in Russian. I get a language out of it, I feel productive, and I have fun. What's not to like? So let's learn how to play. Do this now. The path forward. An organizational note. Over the course of this audiobook, I'm going to introduce you to a lot of tools and resources. If you ever forget which one is which, you'll find them all in the glossary of tools and terms, along with a brief explanation. So with that said, let's get started. I intend to teach you how to learn, rather than what to learn. We can't discuss every word, grammatical system, and pronunciation system that exists, so you'll need some additional resources specific to your language of choice. Speaking of which, you should probably begin by choosing a language to learn. Choose your language. Choose a language based upon employment opportunities, difficulty, availability of resources, or number of speakers, but in the end, choose a language that you like. A reader on my website once asked me whether he should learn Russian or French. His relatives spoke Russian, he loved the culture, but he was worried about the difficulty. French seemed like a safe alternative. Never settle for safe when you can have fun instead. Your language will become a constant companion, living in your head. If you like your language, then you'll have fun studying it, and when you have fun, you learn faster. You have many resources at your disposal. Language books. Get yourself some books. Someone sat down and spent months, or years, heaven forbid, organizing the information you need, and you can have all that effort in the palm of your hand for $15 to $25. Thank you, Herr Gutenberg. In Appendix 1, I list my favorite picks for the top 11 languages you're most likely to be studying. If your language isn't there, go to my website, fluent-forever.com. I aim to have book recommendations for as many languages as people want to learn. Get these now. First, get a good grammar book. This will walk you through your language's grammar in a thoughtful, step-by-step manner. On the way, it will introduce you to 1,000 words or so, give you a bunch of examples and exercises, and provide you with an answer key. You will skip 90% of the exercises in the book, but having them around will save you a lot of time once we start to learn grammar. If the book gives you Englishy pronunciation for each word, things like bonjour is bon plus jour, or tschüss is choose, I give you permission to burn it and find a different one. Walking to a Parisian cafe and saying bonjour is a really good way to get ignored indefinitely by the waiter. If your new book comes with a CD, then so much the better. There are two pitfalls here to avoid. First, avoid books systematically detailing every single solitary rule and detail and exception all at once in an uncontrollable torrent of grammatical despair. I used to love these books until I tried learning from them. These are technical tomes that lay out the entire grammatical system of a language in giant flowcharts. They are lovely reference manuals, but they're very difficult to use in a step-by-step manner. Second, be wary of most classroom books, especially those without an answer key. Books designed for classrooms are often sparse on explanations because they expect that the teacher will be able to handle any confusion. You'll often have more luck with a self-study book. Second, a phrase book. Now, this is a wonderful reference, as it's difficult to find handy phrases like, am I under arrest, and where are you taking me, in a dictionary. Phrasebooks from the Lonely Planet Company are cheap and come with a tiny, extremely practical dictionary in the back. We'll use this dictionary when we learn our first words, because it's a lot easier and faster to skim through than a real dictionary. We'll grudgingly allow bonjour here, but only because there are no phrasebooks without it. Now, consider these books. First, a frequency dictionary. This dictionary typically contains the most important 5,000 words of your target language, arranged in order of frequency. The number one word in English, the, shows up once every 25 words. These books are amazing, with lovingly picked examples and translations. They will save you tons of time, and they take so much work to compile that we should be throwing money and flowers at the feet of their authors. There are some online frequency lists, but they are not as good as the paper versions. Frequency dictionaries don't exist in every language yet, but if your language has one, you win. Get it. Next, a pronunciation guide. This will walk you through the entire pronunciation system of your language with the help of recordings and diagrams of your mouth and tongue. For many languages, you can find guidebooks with CDs devoted entirely to pronunciation. They are wonderful resources and well worth the purchase. In addition, I've made it my personal mission to develop computerized pronunciation trainers in as many languages as I can. These trainers can do a few neat things that textbooks can't, and we'll discuss them in depth in Chapter 3. You won't be able to find a guidebook or trainer in every language, but when they exist, they're extraordinarily helpful. You also want to find two dictionaries. It's up to you whether you find them online or in print. The first is a traditional bilingual dictionary, e.g. English-French and French-English, with accurate pronunciation listed for every word. Again, if you see bonjour, burn it. If you see funny symbols, then keep it. We'll make friends with the International Phonetic Alphabet in Chapter 3. The second dictionary you want is a monolingual dictionary, e.g. French-French, which has actual definitions in French rather than translations. You'll never see bonjour in one of these, and so don't worry about finding your lighter. You may also want a thematic vocabulary book. These books arrange the words in your language by theme. Words about cars, words for food, medical words, and so on. They're handy for customizing your vocabulary, which we'll talk about in detail in Chapter 6. For the intermediates. If you've already spent some time studying your target language, adjust your shopping list as follows. First, if you already have a grammar book, make sure that you actually like it and that it's sufficiently challenging. If not, get a new one that fits your level. Second, if you don't have a phrase book, they're worth having. Even if you're already reading books in your target language, you might not know how to ask about business hours or rental car insurance. A phrase book will let you look up sentences for many day-to-day situations that just don't show up in books. Third, you probably don't have a frequency dictionary yet, and you'll use it much earlier than a beginner. Go get one. And last, hold off on a pronunciation book or trainer until the end of Chapter 3. You'll have a better idea then as to whether you'll need one. The Internet. The Internet is filling up with free grammar guides, pronunciation guides, frequency lists, and dictionaries of all shapes and sizes. The quality varies drastically from site to site and changes daily. You can learn a language for free on the net, but you'll be able to do it faster if you combine the best internet resources with well-written books. I list my favorite internet resources on my website, fluent-forever.com/language-resources. And we'll be discussing the most important websites, Google Images and the new language learning exchange communities like Lang 8, iTalki, and Verbling throughout this book. Tutors and programs. If you need faster results and have some funds to spare, you can speed up your learning with private tutors, who are extremely affordable at italki.com, or intensive programs at home and abroad. The fastest route to fluency is also the least convenient. Intensive immersion programs will provide 20-plus weekly hours of class time, 10 to 20 weekly hours of homework, and a strict no-English policy. You'll leave with a comfortable proficiency in your language of choice in exchange for 2 months of your life and a wad of cash. Some of them have generous financial aid policies if you apply early enough, so they may be within your reach if you lack the funds but have the time. Language classes. In this book, we're going to discuss the process of learning a language on your own, outside of the classroom. But if you're already enrolled in a class, or if there's some good, affordable classes offered nearby, then be sure to check out Appendix 6, How to Use This Book with Your Classroom Language Course. The Path Forward. In the coming chapters, we will knock down language's challenges one by one. I'll introduce you to a memorization system that will allow you to remember thousands of facts effortlessly and permanently. Then we'll determine which facts to learn. I'll guide you step by step through your language's sounds, words, and grammar. Every step of the way, we'll use your memorization system to learn more rapidly. And finally, we'll develop your listening and reading comprehension as we pave a path towards fluent speech. Along the way, I'll show you all my favorite toys. I like finding ways to make life more efficient, even when finding a faster way to do something takes more time than simply doing it. Someday, the month I spent memorizing 100 composers' birth dates and death dates will pay off in time savings, but it hasn't quite yet. When it comes to efficiency in language learning, I got lucky. I needed to learn 4 languages to fluency for my singing. Beyond these, I want to learn Yiddish, Hebrew, and Hungarian to speak with my relatives, and I am fascinated by Japanese. With so many languages to learn, I could spend an enormous amount of time looking for efficiency and still justify that time expense. As a result, I have a chest full of neat tools and toys to play with. And we'll begin with my favorite one, the spaced repetition system. Chapter 2. Upload. 5 Principles to End Forgetting. A man's real possession is his memory. In nothing else is he rich. In nothing else is he poor. Alexander Smith. A scene from The Matrix, Warner Brothers Pictures, 1999. Tank smiles as he sits down in his operator's chair, flipping through several discs. He picks one and puts it into his computer. Neo looks at the screen. Jiu-jitsu? I'm gonna learn jiu-jitsu? Smiling, Tank presses the load button. Neo's body jumps against the harness as his eyes clamp shut. The monitors kick wildly as his heart pounds, adrenaline surges, and his brain sizzles. An instant later, his eyes snap open. Holy shit! Tank grins. While we can't yet upload jiu-jitsu directly into our brains, we do have technology that can help us learn faster. This technology derives its power from five principles of memory. 1. Make memories more memorable. 2. Maximize laziness. 3. Don't review, recall. 4. Wait, don't tell me. And 5. Rewrite the past. These principles will enable you to remember more in less time. Combined, they form a system that can insert thousands of words and grammar rules so deeply into your mind that you'll be able to recall them instantly. Most attractively, this system can take what little spare time you have and steadily turn that into a usable foreign language. Principle 1. Make memories more memorable.
Qualsiasi dato diventa importante se è connesso a un altro.
Any fact becomes important when it's connected to another.
Umberto Eco, Foucault's Pendulum.
To learn to remember, we must learn about the nature and location of memory. Scientists working in the 1940s and 50s began their search for memory in the most obvious place, within the cells of our brains, our neurons. They cut out parts of rats' brains, trying to make them forget a maze, and they found that it didn't matter what part of the brain they chose. The rats never forgot. In 1950, the researchers gave up, concluding that they had most definitely searched everywhere and that memory must be somewhere else. Researchers eventually turned their search for memories to the wiring between neurons, rather than within the cells themselves. Each of the 100 billion neurons in our brains are, on average, connected to 7,000 other neurons, in a dense web of more than 150,000 kilometers of nerve fibers. These interconnected webs are intricately involved in our memories, which is why scientists could never find the mazes in their rats. Each rat's maze was spread throughout its brain. Whenever the scientists cut out a piece, they damaged only a small portion of the involved connections. The more they removed, the longer it took the rats to remember, but they never forgot their mazes completely. The only way to remove the maze entirely was to remove the rat entirely. These patterns of connections form an elegantly simple, mechanical process. Neurons that fire together wire together. Known as Hebb's Law, this principle helps explain how we remember anything. Take my first memory of cookies. I spent 10 minutes waiting in front of the oven, bathed in radiating heat and the scent of butter, flour, and sugar. I waited until they came out of the oven and watched the steam rise up off of them as they cooled. When I could bear no more, my father gave me a glass of milk, I grabbed a cookie, and I learned empathy from my poor blue friend from Sesame Street. My neural network for cookies involves sight, smell, and taste. There are audio components, the sound of the word cookie, and the sound of milk pouring into a glass. I remember my dad's face smiling as he bit into his own delicious cookie. This first cookie experience was a parade of sensations, which wired together into a tight web of neural connections. These connections enable me to return to my past whenever I encounter a new cookie. Faced with a familiar buttery scent, that old web of neurons reactivates. My brain plays back the same sights, sounds, emotions, and tastes, and I relive my childhood experience. Compare this experience to a new one. You're currently forming memory of the word Mjöðr. M, J, O with an umlaut, backward six with a line through it, U, R. Now, there's not much of a parade here. It's not obvious how to pronounce it, and in a particularly obnoxious move, I'm not even telling you what it means. As a result, you're stuck looking at the structure of the word. It has those two foreign letters sandwiched in between four familiar ones, and then not much else. Without Herculean efforts, you'll forget Mjöðr by the end of this chapter, if not sooner. Levels of processing. The great mnemonic filter. The divide that separates your new Mjöðr from my cookie is known as levels of processing, and it separates the memorable from the forgettable. My cookie is memorable because it contains so many connections. I can access cookie in 1,000 different ways. I will remember cookies if I read about them, if I hear about them, see them, smell them, or taste them. The word is unforgettable. We need to make your Mjöðr just as unforgettable, and we will do it by adding four types of connections: structure, sound, concept, and personal connection. These are the four levels of processing. They were identified in the 1970s by psychologists who created a curious questionnaire with four types of questions and gave it to college students. On that questionnaire, they would ask questions about words like bear, apple, tool, and pizza. Questions like these. 1. Structure. How many capital letters are in the word bear? 2. Sound. Does apple rhyme with snapple? 3. Concept. Is tool another word for instrument? And 4. Personal connection. Do you like pizza? After that questionnaire, they gave the students a surprise memory test, asking which words from the test they still remembered. Their memories were dramatically influenced by the question types. Students remembered 6 pizzas for every bear. The magic of these questions lies in a peculiar mental trick. To count the capital letters in bear, you don't need to think about brown furry animals, and so you don't. You've activated the shallowest level of processing, structure, and moved on. On the other hand, you activate regions throughout your brain to determine whether you like pizza. You automatically utilize structure to figure out what word you're looking at. At the same time, you'll tend to hear the word pizza echoing within your skull as you imagine a hot disk of cheesy goodness. Finally, you'll access memories of pizza's past to determine whether you enjoy pizza or just haven't met the right one yet. In a fraction of a second, a simple question, "Do you like pizza?" can simultaneously activate all 4 levels of processing. These 4 levels will fire together, wire together, and form a robust memory that is 6 times easier to remember than that bear you've likely already forgotten. The 4 levels of processing are more than a biological quirk. They act as a filter, protecting us from information overload. We live in a sea of information, surrounded by a dizzying amount of input from TV, the internet, books, social interactions, and the events of our lives. Your brain uses levels of processing to judge which input is important and which should be thrown out. You don't want to be thinking about the number of letters in the word tiger when one is chasing after you, nor do you want to be assaulted by vivid memories of cows when you buy milk. To keep you sane, your brain constantly works at the shallowest level of processing needed to get the job done. At the grocery store, you are simply looking for the words chocolate milk, or perhaps even organic wholesome happy cow chocolate milk. This is pattern matching, and your brain uses structure to quickly weed through hundreds or thousands of ingredient lists and food labels. Thankfully, you forget nearly every one of these lists and labels by the time you reach your milk. If you didn't, your encyclopedic knowledge of supermarket brand names would make you a terrible bore at parties. In more stimulating circumstances, such as that tiger in Hot Pursuit, your brain has a vested interest in memory. In such a case, should you survive, you'll likely remember not to climb into the tiger enclosure at the zoo. In this way, levels of processing act as our great mental filter, keeping us alive and tolerable at parties. This filter is one of the reasons why foreign words are difficult to remember. Your brain is just doing its job. How should it know that you want to remember Mjöder, but not disodium phosphate, an emulsifier in that chocolate milk? How to remember a foreign word forever. To create a robust memory for a word like Mjöder, you'll need all 4 levels of processing. The shallowest level structure allows you to recognize patterns of letters and determine whether a word is long, short, and written in English or in Japanese. Your brain is recognizing structure when you unscramble O-D-C-T-O-R into doctor. This level is essential for reading, but it involves too little of your brain to contribute much to memory. Almost none of the students in the levels of processing study remembered counting the capital letters in the word bear. Words like Mjöder are difficult to remember because you can't get any deeper than structure until you know how to deal with odd letters like O with an umlaut or a backward 6 with a line through it. Your first task in language learning is to reach the next level, sound. Sound connects structure to your ears and your mouth and allows you to speak. You'll start by learning the sounds of your language and which letters make those sounds, because if you begin with sound, you'll have a much easier time remembering words. Our college students remembered twice as many apples, which do in fact rhyme with snapples, as they did bears, which had 4 capital letters in that test. Sound is the land of rote memorization. We take a name like Edward, or a pair of words like cat, gato, and we repeat them, continuously activating the parts of our brain that connect structure to sound. Our new foreign word is pronounced Mjöder, and the more accurately we learn its pronunciation, the better we'll remember it. Eventually, our Mjöðr will be as memorable as a familiar name like Edward. This is better than structure, but it still isn't good enough for our needs. After all, many of us don't remember names very well, because our brains are filtering them out as quickly as they arrive. We need a way to get through this filter, and we'll find it at the third level of processing, concepts. Our college students remembered twice as many tools, synonym for instruments, as apples, snapples. Concepts can be broken down into two groups, abstract and concrete. We'll begin with the abstract. If I tell you that my birthday is in June, you probably won't immediately see images of birthday cakes and party hats. You don't need to, and as we've discussed, our brains work at the shallowest level required. It's efficient, and it saves us a lot of work and distraction. Still, the date of my birthday is a meaningful, if abstract, concept. This makes it deeper and more memorable than pure sounds, which is why you'll have an easier time remembering that my birthday is in June than you'll have remembering that the Basque word for birthday is urtebetetse. Deeper still than abstract concepts are concrete, multisensory concepts. If I tell you that my upcoming birthday party will take place in a paintball arena, after which we'll eat a cookies and cream ice cream cake and spend the rest of the evening in a swimming pool, you'll tend to remember those details much better than you'll remember the month of the event. We prioritize and store concrete concepts because they engage more of our brains, not because they're necessarily any more important than other information. In this case, it is less important that you know the details about my birthday than that you know when and where to show up. Given this phenomenon, how do we make a strange foreign word like Mjöðr memorable? The word itself is not the problem. We're not bad at remembering words when they're tied to concrete multisensory experiences. If I tell you that my email password is Mjöðr, you probably, or hopefully, won't remember it, because you're processing it on a sound and structural level. But if we're in a bar together, and I hand you a flaming drink with a dead snake in it, and I tell you, "This, Mjöðr, you drink," you won't have any trouble remembering that word. We have no problem naming things. Nouns comprise the vast majority of the 450,000 entries in Webster's Third International Dictionary. It's when those names aren't tied to concrete concepts that we run into trouble with our memories. Our goal, and one of the core goals of this book, is to make foreign words like Mjöðr more concrete and meaningful. Breaking through the filter, the power of images and personal connections. Earlier in this chapter, we encountered a translated word pair, cat, gato. As we discussed, standard study practice involves repeating gato and cat until they form a sound connection. And this is too shallow to remember easily, but it's also beside the point. When you read gato, you don't want to think the word cat. We'll get better results if we skip the English word and use an image instead. We recall images much better than words, because we automatically think conceptually when we see an image. Image recall studies have repeatedly demonstrated that our visual memory is phenomenal. Memory researchers in the 1960s subjected college students to one of the most terrifyingly named memory tests ever invented, the two alternative forced choice test. In it, college students were shown 612 magazine ads, possibly tied to chairs with their eyes held open, and then asked to identify the old pictures when shown a new mixture of images. The students correctly picked the old images 98.5% of the time. Unsatisfied, the researchers repeated their tests with more images, trying to determine what college students will put up with for low pay and free food. There doesn't seem to be a limit. Students were willing to sit in dark rooms for 5 consecutive days, watching 10,000 images in a row. After the study, these students accurately identified 83% of the images. Our capacity for visual memory is extraordinary. We only need to learn how to take advantage of it. Since we need to learn words, not pictures, we will use combinations of words and pictures. Such combinations work even better than pictures alone. This effect even applies to totally unrelated images. You will remember an abstract drawing with the sentence, "Apples are delicious," better than that drawing alone. Faced with an incomprehensible image and an unrelated word, your brain struggles to find meaning, even if there isn't any. In the process, it automatically moves the word out of the disodium phosphate trash can and into cookie territory. And as a result, you'll remember. We can go one step deeper than pictures by taking advantage of the last level, personal connection. You'll remember a concept with a personal connection 50% more easily than a concept without one. which is why our college students remembered 50% more pizzas. Yes, they did like them. Than tools. Yes, they are synonymous with instruments. That's not to say that concepts alone are ineffective. If you connect gato to an image of some cute cat, you will have an easy time remembering that word. But if in addition you can connect gato with a memory of your own childhood cat, then that word will become practically unforgettable. How do we use this in practice? Well, a new foreign word is like a new friend's name. Our new friend could be a person, a cat, or a drink. The memory burden in each case is the same. Let's make a new friend's name memorable using levels of processing. Our new friend is named Edward. Simply by thinking Edward, we've already reached the second level of processing, sound. If we want to go deeper into concept territory, we would search for a concrete image for the name Edward, such as the movie character, Edward Scissorhands. If we spent a moment imagining our new friend with a pair of scissors for hands, we would have an easy time remembering his name later. This strategy is used by competitive memorizers, and yes, there are competitive memorizers, to quickly memorize people's names, and we'll discuss it in depth in chapters 4 and 5. But we're not done yet. We'll do even better if we can find a personal connection with his name. Perhaps you still remember watching Edward Scissorhands in a theater. Perhaps your brother is named Edward, or perhaps you too have hands made out of scissors. As you imagine your new friend interacting with Edward-related images and Edward-related personal memories, you're activating broader and broader networks in your brain. The next time you see Edward, this parade of images and memories will come rushing back, and you'll be hard-pressed to forget his name. This gives you valuable social points, which are sometimes redeemable for wine, cheese, and board game nights. This thought process can take creativity, but you can learn to do it quickly and easily. For a concrete word like gato, you can find an appropriate image on Google Images, images.google.com, within seconds. You simply ask yourself, well, when's the last time I saw a gato? You will add a personal connection and cement your memory of the word. Easy. For an abstract word like economia, economy, our job is still very simple. When we search Google Images, we'll find thousands of pictures of money, piggy banks, stock market charts, and politicians. By choosing any of these images, we'll force ourselves to think concretely and conceptually. As a result, the word will become much easier to remember. If we ask ourselves whether the economia has affected our lives, we'll get the personal connection we need to remember that word forever. In this book, we're going to learn vocabulary in two main stages. We'll build a foundation of easy, concrete words, and then we'll use that foundation to learn abstract words. Throughout, we'll use levels of processing to make foreign words memorable. Key points. Your brain is a sophisticated filter, which makes irrelevant information forgettable and meaningful information memorable. Foreign words tend to fall into the forgettable category because they sound odd and they don't seem particularly meaningful and they don't have any connection to your own life experiences. You can get around this filter and make foreign words memorable by doing three things. One, learn the sound system of your language. Two, bind those sounds to images. And then three, bind those images to your past experiences. Principle 2. Maximize laziness. I've heard that hard work never killed anyone, but I say, why take the chance? Ronald Reagan. Forgetting is a formidable opponent. We owe our present understanding of forgetting to Hermann Ebbinghaus, a German psychologist who spent years of his life memorizing lists of nonsense syllables, guff, rill, zhick, nish, mip, puff. He recorded the speed of forgetting by comparing the time it took him to learn and then later relearn one of his lists. His forgetting curve is a triumph of experimental psychology, tenacity, and masochism. If we chart his curve, we find that 20 minutes after he memorized a list, he only remembered 60% of it. A day later, he remembered 30% of it. A month later, 20%, and 10 years later, 10%. The curve reveals how rapidly we forget and what remains once we've forgotten. The right side of his curve is encouraging. Even years later, Ebbinghaus could expect old random gobbledygook to take him measurably less time to learn than new random gobbledygook. Once he learned something, a trace of it remained within him forever. Unfortunately, the left side of the curve is a disaster. Our memories rush out of our ears like water through a net. The net stays damp, but if we're trying to keep something substantial in it, like telephone numbers, the names of people we've just met, or new foreign words, we can expect to remember a paltry 30% the following day. How can we do better? Our instinct is to work harder. It's what gets us through school tests and social occasions. When we meet our new friend Edward, we generally remember his name with rote repetition. We repeat his name to ourselves until we remember. If we need to remember, perhaps Edward is our new boss, then we can repeat his name continuously until we're sick of it. If we do this extra work, we'll remember his name significantly better. For a few weeks. Extra repetition is known as overlearning, and it doesn't help long-term memory at all. Can you remember a single fact from the last school test you crammed for? Can you even remember the test itself? If we're going to invest our time in a language, we want to remember for months, years, or decades. If we can't achieve this goal by working harder, then we'll do it by working as little as possible. Key points. Rote repetition is boring, and it doesn't work for long-term memorization. So take the lazy route instead. Study a concept until you can repeat it once without looking, and then stop. After all, lazy is just another word for efficient. Principle 3. Don't review. Recall. In school, we learn things, then take the test. In everyday life, we take the test, then we learn things. Admon Israel. Suppose I made you an offer. I'll give you $20 for every word you can remember from a list of Spanish words. The test is in a week, and you have two options. One, you can study the list for 10 minutes. Or two, you can study the list for 5 minutes, and then trade it for a blank sheet of paper and a pencil. If you choose the second option, you can write down whatever you still remember, and then you have to give the sheet back. Here are results from a similarly worded experiment. In it, students either read a text twice or read it once and wrote down what they remembered. Then they took a final test 5 minutes, 2 days, or 1 week later. Researchers found that studying twice, or overlearning, helps for a few minutes, but then it screws you in the long run. 2 days later and 1 week later, students who studied and then tested themselves remembered 10% more than the students who studied twice. Oddly enough, a blank sheet of paper will help you much more than additional study time. You'll remember 35% more in a week. Now let's try this one. After reading through your Spanish word list, you can do one of these three things. A, get 5 more minutes with your word list. B, get a blank sheet of paper and test yourself. Or C, get 3 blank sheets of paper and test yourself 3 times. Your final test results 1 week later. A, just studying. You'll remember just under 30%. B, studying and then testing yourself. You'll remember around 40%. Or C, study and then test yourself 3 times. You'll remember nearly 55%. This is madness. How can taking an identical test 3 times in a row produce such a large effect? Odd as it is, this follows rules of common sense. When you study by reading through a list multiple times, you're practicing reading, not recall. If you want to get better at recalling something, you should practice recalling it. Our blank sheet of paper, which could be replaced by a stack of flashcards, a multiple choice test, or simply trying to remember to yourself, is precisely the type of practice we need. It improves our ability to recall by tapping into one of the most fascinating facets of our minds, the interplay of memory and emotion. Deep within our brains, a seahorse and a nut are engaged in an intricate chemical dance that allows us to decide what is important and what is forgettable. The seahorse-shaped structure is known as the hippocampus, and it acts as a mental switchboard, connecting distant regions of the brain and creating a map of those connections. You access this map in order to recall any recent memory. The connected neurons reactivate and you relive your past experience. Over the course of months and years, these networked neurons lose their dependency on the hippocampus's map and take on an independent, bohemian lifestyle in the outermost layers of the brain. The hippocampus's nut-shaped dance partner is the amygdala, and it tells the hippocampus what to keep and what to throw out. It does this by translating our emotions into chemicals, causing our adrenal glands to send out bursts of memory-enhancing hormones according to the situation. If we encounter emotionally arousing input, look, a tiger, ow, my arm, then the amygdala will strengthen that memory. If not, look, a pencil, I'm hungry, then it won't. This leaves us with a healthy fear of tigers and a healthy disregard for pencils as food items. Coupled with the nearby reward centers in the brain, The amygdala provides the mechanism behind our magical blank sheet of paper. Our emotions are reflexive creatures. They respond to our environment whether we want them to or not. While we can try to trick our brains into getting excited over a list of Spanish words, our brains know better. Unless learning that el dentista means the dentist in Spanish gives you goosebumps, your amygdala will not give those memories much of a boost. El dentista is just not as important as el tigre. You can try to inject amphetamine directly into your amygdala, which will work, but that may prove to be more trouble than it's worth. Our blank page, however, changes everything. At the moment where your performance is judged, your brain realizes that it had better get its act in gear. As a result, every memory you recall gets a squirt of memory-boosting chemicals. Those memories are reactivated. Your amygdala calls for hormones. Your hippocampus maps out the involved networks, and your neurons wire tightly together. Every time you succeed at recalling, the reward centers in your brain release a chemical reward, dopamine, into your hippocampus, further encouraging long-term memory storage. Your blank sheet of paper has created a drug-fueled memory party in your brain. Your boring word list never stood a chance. Key points. 1. Acts of recall set off an intricate chemical dance in your brain that boosts memory retention. 2. To maximize efficiency, spend most of your time recalling rather than reviewing. And 3. You'll accomplish this goal by creating flashcards that test your ability to recall a given word, pronunciation, or grammatical construction. Coupled with images and personal connections, these flashcards will form the foundation of a powerful memorization system. Principle 4. Wait, don't tell me. If it's hard to remember, it'll be difficult to forget. Arnold Schwarzenegger. We've all gone through situations in school and work in which we're supposed to memorize something, but rarely does someone tell us how to do it. This is not without good reason. There is no such thing as memorizing. We can think, we can repeat, we can recall, and we can imagine, but we aren't built to memorize. Rather, our brains are designed to think and automatically hold on to what's important. While running away from our friendly neighborhood tiger, we don't think, "You need to remember this. Tigers are bad. Don't forget. They're bad." We simply run away, and our brain remembers for us. The closest mental action that we have to memorizing is practicing recall. What was that guy's name? So now we need to investigate precisely what effective recall feels like. Try to recall the foreign words that have shown up so far in this book. You'll remember some words immediately, perhaps the words from the previous section, el tigre, el dentista. If you keep looking, you'll find a few more in relatively easy reach. Perhaps gato is still lurking about. Last, hiding in the murky fog of your brain, a few words may reluctantly emerge. If we were to track your ability to remember each of these words, we would see a curious result. By next week, you're most likely to forget the words you knew best, those words that you remembered immediately. You're 20% more likely to retain the words that took a little more time. But the words that took the most effort to recall, those you had all but forgotten, those will etch themselves deeply into your consciousness. You're 75% more likely to remember them in the future, and if they spent a few moments just out of reach at the tip of your tongue, then you're twice as likely to remember them. What's going on here? Let's look at the most extreme example, a word that dances on the tip of your tongue before you finally recall it. A word like this is an incomplete memory. You have access to fragments of the word, but you can't see the whole picture yet. You can recall that it starts with the letter S, or that it's something like a poem or a monologue, or that it sounds like solipsist or solitaire, but you need time to reach the word soliloquy. More often than not, in these situations, we recall accurate information. Our word does start with the letter S. Our brains fly into a wild, almost desperate search for the missing piece of our minds, frantically generating S words and throwing them out when they don't match what we're looking for. Your amygdala treats these searches as matters of life and death. For surely, if you don't remember the actor who played Matt Damon's therapist in Good Will Hunting, you will leap out of the nearest window. And it was Robin Williams. You experience such relief at finally finding your goal that the word becomes nearly impossible to forget. How do we take advantage of this? Do we even want to? Tricking our brains into a permanent, desperate chase after missing words sounds stressful. Doing this 100 times a day sounds like a recipe for early heart failure. Fortunately, we don't need to be stressed to remember. We just need to be interested. We'll get bored if we spend our days incessantly asking ourselves whether we still remember our friend Edward's name. It's too easy, it's tedious, and it doesn't work very well. If we wait longer until we're just about to forget, then remembering Edward's name becomes a stimulating challenge. We're aiming for the point where a dash of difficulty